it's important to have a sense of how to deal with certain ideas that are being promulgated, that are being disseminated. This is important for people at virtually every phase of their life, but especially for students. Because you go to schools and you hear different ideas stated in the name of certain rabbis or by certain rabbis, and or you read it in books. And what I find to be a problem, especially with the attitude in contemporary Jewish life, is a lack of a critical approach towards ideas. Today's students, in my opinion, many of them, have sort of been intimidated from using their minds, their intelligence, in determining what is acceptable, what is true, what makes sense in terms of Jewish doctrines. By Jewish doctrines over here, I'm not talking about so much halachic. When you come to halacha, there is a system that has to be utilized, and the role of authority is very significant, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in the area of hashkafa, which is understanding the ideas of Judaism, the philosophical foundations of Judaism, the worldview, the attitude of Judaism. And it seems to me that there's a tremendous deficiency in this area, that there are many ideas out there that are being passed off as Jewish doctrine, which upon analysis have no validity whatsoever. And yet there's a certain type of an intimidation that students, not just students, even balabatim, so to speak, are intimidated, because if it depends, if the idea is being promoted by an authority or someone who wrote a book, it attains a certain validity. Especially also, you have another factor, is that if these ideas are popular ideas. Now, most people, the more popular the idea, the more popular the author or the speaker, to them that's a greater sense that there must be something to it. That itself is not analyzed. To the contrary, I'm very suspicious of anyone who's popular in this area. If a rabbi becomes extremely popular, to me, that's a sign to suspect them. If a book becomes extremely popular, then it's hard to imagine that this book contains real truth. Because the whole nature of Judaism, the nature of true ideas, the great thinkers of Judaism that were unconcerned about the emotional impact of what they were saying, but were only concerned with the truth, is that that's extremely unpopular. The real truths of Judaism, real truth per se, is something which, at least at first glance, people have tremendous resistance to, and especially religious people, because religious people, by and large, are closed-minded people. Religious people are very far from being rational, and religious people are not interested in truth. And thus, if something becomes extremely popular, it must mean that it's appealing to very powerful emotions. If it was a sober, realistic analysis of truth, and it would indicate to people that the way they're living their lives is not in line with the reality of what Judaism is teaching, it's very difficult to imagine that this would become extremely popular. The Mor Nevuchim, arguably the greatest work in Jewish philosophy ever, was not a popular book, and to this day is not a popular book. People are drawn today to things which appeal to their emotions. People will flock to come out and spend time with someone who has claims to have supernatural kinds of powers or insights, or will be able to read your mezuzah and determine why you're having problems in your life. People are drawn to these types of ideas, wearing red strings around their wrists, because the thread passed over Kever Rachel, things of that sort. People are attracted to all types of irrational phenomena, which are panaceas for what they regard as the ills in life. they're not drawn to study, to knowledge, to truth, especially to something which is rationalistic. It's important to realize that you're not supposed to accept something as being true simply because it appears in a book, or simply because it was stated by an authority, and even a great authority, even a genuine authority. It's important to read through the Rav Avram ben Arambam wrote an essay on an approach to the Agadot. And he makes it clear over there that a person is not obligated, not supposed to, accept an idea as being true merely because of the authority, no matter how great the authority is, even if he's a prophet. That is, when he's expressing an interpretation, when a person is expressing an interpretation, he's presenting something as his idea based upon certain sources, based upon reasoning, based upon interpretation, then you're not supposed to accept it. You're supposed to critically analyze it, study it, try to understand what he's saying, try to make sense out of it. And when you see the truth of the idea, then you accept it. But you don't accept it as true simply because this great rabbi said it. We're about to take up an idea that was stated. It's being ascribed to Rabbi Cook, who was a great rabbi, no question. And we're going to be analyzing it. This should serve as an illustration. The fact that this idea was stated by Rabbi Cook, let's assume that it was. I mean, others are saying it over in his name, so it's not fair to attribute an idea to someone just because somebody said it over. Maybe they didn't say it over properly. But aside from that, even if it's clear that this is what he said, the mere fact that he said it does not give it any assurance of being true. Yeah, we have to accept it. Because we're talking about a philosophical idea, which is his understanding of certain phenomena. In this case, it's how he understood certain movements in history. And it's his assessment. Certainly we have to respect the individual, since the individual is a great man and a thinker and knowledgeable. We're going to listen to that and treat it seriously. But by no means will that have any effect whatsoever on whether we accept it or whether we reject it. We will then forget who it is that stated it, and we'll just treat it as an idea. This is what the Rambam said in his Akdama to the Shmona Prakim. The Rambam wrote an introduction to the Pirkei Avos, which he called the eight chapters, which have to do with principles, essentially principles of psychology and ethics. And he said that this is nothing new. It didn't originate with him. And most of the ideas he's put together from great thinkers who preceded them, not necessarily Jewish thinkers, because truth is truth. And he said he's not going to mention the names of the authorities, because he does not want people to relate to the ideas from the standpoint of who said the ideas. He was making this very same point. Shema ha'emes mipi ha'omro. Hear the truth from whoever says it. It is irrelevant who says the idea. This concept that we have to approach positions not from the standpoint of who said it, which is exactly, that unfortunately permeates the Jewish world today. In my opinion, the yeshiva world, the Jewish college world, the Jewish intellectual world has been tremendously affected by what goes on in the secular world, where people are not involved in ideas whatsoever. When you study a subject in college, you're not studying a subject. You're studying accidents about the subject. When you're studying philosophy, you're not really studying philosophy. Basically, it's a history. You get an outline. This philosopher said such and such, and these are the reasons why he said it. But you don't go into the reasons to see whether you can actually get to the underlying phenomena. You just have to be able to state those reasons. Then it was rebutted by this other philosopher, and for these following reasons. But at this point in time, you have no idea which one makes more sense than the other. It's just a bunch. And then you go on, and it's the history. But you never really can get to the underlying phenomena. You're never really studying philosophy. You can study philosophy in an academy for for 20 years, for 30 years, you yourself never have anything to do with philosophy. That's why people who have PhDs in philosophy, they themselves are not philosophers. They're students of philosophy, but they're not philosophers. They can't construct the philosophy because they never get into the underlying foundations of what philosophy is. They're historians. Basically, they're historians. And the subject matter is what philosophers have said. So they're able to give something of an overview. That's the same thing that's happening in the Jewish world. That's Rabbi Hirsch. This is a Hirsch. This is a Rabbi Cook. This is the other rabbi. That's what he says. So now you know what all these different rabbis said. But do you understand anything? You don't really know what they said. You could just say over what they said. Saying over what they said is not understanding. Understanding is the phenomena. When you're talking about the phenomena, then you're not interested in a person. You want to know the phenomena itself. You want to understand it, and you want to be able to reach a decision that makes sense to your mind. Well, you can use these people as guides to the extent that they expressed and elucidated, but that's not the case. The attitude today is we really can't think. We don't have a right to think. All we can do is read the works of authorities, and then somehow or other you put together something. But unfortunately, what's taking place is when people are putting forth certain types of philosophies, we discussed yesterday an idea which becomes very, very compelling and very powerful, such as the idea that everybody has a particular tafkid. And we analyze that at length. This becomes accepted as gospel truth, with no basis, no foundation whatsoever. Because people today are not trained in the basic principles of a philosophy, of hashkafa, of what the real doctrines of Judaism are. And I explained, in certain areas they make fundamental mistakes. The whole approach to the issue of divine providence. Does everything that happens in the world, is everything an expression of divine providence, or is there such a thing as the laws of nature? These are crucial questions. And the way the answers are determined is not through study. The way the answers are determined is, well, what's more appealing to the religious imagination, which is a complete falsification. So that's what we're trying to do over here, is to get away from that to the best of our ability and to establish a hashkafa, which is based upon study of the phenomenon and genuine foundations. And what we're going to apply that approach to this particular doctrine that's being ascribed to Rabbi Cook. We're discussing a certain idea which has been attributed to someone who would be considered a great rabbi. I'm not going to mention the person's name because I don't have first-hand knowledge that this person stated the idea. And it's not fair to attribute an idea to someone unless you have knowledge of that from reliable sources, or you've read the works yourself, or it's very clear that this is what this person held. Then you can ascribe the idea to the person. And what you must do is proceed to analyze that idea, to ascertain the foundations that it's based upon, the reasoning that's behind it, and to be able to arrive at an intelligent conclusion as to whether it's true or not true. That constitutes real study, which unfortunately is not the norm in the Jewish world today, where a different attitude is taken. Today, the Jewish world in general, in my opinion, is not engaged in the search for truth. And it is involved in study, but the study essentially, and I'm talking about the arena of hashkafa, of philosophy, is to go through the works of somebody and to establish what the doctrines were and perhaps what the foundations of the doctrines were, but not to engage in really critical thinking and to get into the phenomena which the person is dealing with and to be able to make decisions as to whether this makes sense or doesn't make sense. Rather, it makes sense because this is the position of so-and-so. And if you don't like the position, or there's something that's not appealing to you, so then you find somebody else. Okay, so-and-so said this, but I agree with the other authority. And essentially, you're not engaged in a search for truth. But today, I believe that when it comes to the area of Hashkafa, people choose. They wind up choosing on the basis of that which they feel comfortable with. They're looking for comfort. And the objective of Judaism is not to provide people with comfort. That is not the objective of Judaism. True Judaism does not provide comfort in that kind of sense. A person who's taking that position is saying that basically I'm following my own inner feelings, but I need a system to relate it to pin it on, so to give my feelings some type of validity. And for example, when you'll hear most people, when they hear a speaker, which is the reason why I stated that if something is extremely popular, then it's questionable. One should question it. Most people, when they hear a speaker and they like very much, you ask them why they like it, will not talk about the logic, the clarity, the compelling nature of the presentation of the ideas, but rather it's because it corresponds to what they feel. They feel so strongly about this. So it's basically rooted in the idea that the truth is what I feel. The fact that I feel so strongly about it somehow or other makes it true. Judaism is a system which conveys the truths, the realities that are pertinent to human existence to a person. And occasionally they may be in line with certain emotions of a person, but most of the time it's not going to be in line with a person's emotions. And the challenge in Judaism is for a person to overcome the emotions and to transform his emotions so that they are in line with the truth, not to transform the truth so it should be in line with a person's emotions, which I believe to a great extent is what's happening. The statement that I'm referring to, which I'm going to omit the name of the rabbi because we can't confirm that he actually said it, is that in every significant movement in history that obtained a great deal of popularity, you'll always find that there was something good in it, some element of goodness there. It seems, the way the idea is being presented, is that there's a connection, it would have to be that way, that in order for something to be very, very significant in human history, it would have to be based upon some type of truth. You couldn't say that there's no truth in this whatsoever. The other thing that has to be borne in mind is that when an idea is presented in the name of a great thinker, someone who's recognized as a great thinker, and it evokes a certain type of response, say at first glance, it doesn't seem to make sense to you. Since this is being stated by a great thinker, we have to react to it in a certain way. As I've said, just because an idea is stated by a great thinker does not mean that the idea has to be true and that we have to accept it. However, we have to respect it in the sense that you want to check it out. Make sure that you understand the idea, and also you understand how the person arrived at that idea. What's the basis? What's the foundation for the idea? Then and only then can you undertake a legitimate type of an analysis. However, it does not make any sense at all to say that one has to accept it simply because it was said by a great thinker. Because we don't assume any type of infallibility. When I study ideas of great thinkers, I try to use this approach. Since they are great thinkers, I give them respect. I study to the best of my ability to see that I understand what they're saying. And if I'm not sure, I'll consult with others till I reach the point where I am convinced that I understand what they're saying. And then, of course, I want to understand the bases, the reasons, the sources, and how they learn these sources. Then, however, I put aside, once I have that information, I am no longer interested in who said it. It doesn't make any difference to me who said it. I now have to study it to see whether it makes sense, whether I can regard it as being true. And the fact that it's being said by a certain person is of no consequence any longer. The idea has to be treated on its merits. The same would be true if someone who really does not have any kind of reputation, any kind of name, would say something, would state an idea, which seemed to have possibilities, and upon analysis, the more you think about it, the more you see this person has come upon something, has discovered something, and it's a fantastic idea. But how could it be? This person is an unknown. He's not even a rabbi. In the same way, you are not to be at all concerned by who said the idea. Once you're involved in the study of the idea, it's the knowledge per se that will determine the outcome. As I said, the Rambam, in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, the 8 chapters, said he would not mention the sources of the ideas, and the reason being, relate to the truth on the basis of the factors which determine truth. Shema ha'emes mipi ha'omro. Hear the truth from whoever said it. Whoever said it is of no consequence whatsoever. In my opinion, to a large extent, this approach is gone in Judaism today. Today, Jewish children are trained authorities. This is a Hirshian concept. This is Rav Kook. This is the other one. That's that. But to get past that and into the world of ideas per se, that idea of a true search for truth within the framework of Judaism, utilizing the proper sources of Judaism, is not being emphasized today. That's a personal opinion. Let us now turn to the idea in question and analyze it. That is, the statement that any significant movement, which was extremely popular, which affected many, many people, had to have some element of truth to it. The statement that's being made in defense of this is that if something is very, very appealing to the emotions, then by virtue of that fact alone, there'd have to be some truth in it. Otherwise, how could it be so appealing to the emotions? It seems that in virtually every area of life, the more a person allows themselves to come to decisions about reality on the basis of how they feel about something, the more they are in danger of making a mistake. The opposite idea, the idea that it has to conform, is based upon the fact that since I feel this way about something, the feeling that I have has to be related, has to be based upon the truth. But those who study human nature know, to the contrary, that the emotions are very easily deceived. And what the emotions perceive is a distorted picture of reality. And advertising, for example, is based upon that. In every area of life, you'll see how the emotions fool you in the area of relationships, in the area of love. How many times, and this is a simple thing, this is not a profound idea, anyone who says that they met this girl and they're in love with her and she's so wonderful and she's so kind and she's got all these great qualities, anybody will tell you that you really don't know her at all. This is how you feel. And you should not base yourself at all on any kind of conclusion because of how you feel. That is to say, due to the way human nature is set up, and this is part of the Torah, that the Yetzer Hara has the capacity to deceive a person. Any psychologist understands how this works. When there's a powerful desire for something, so all the forces in the psyche project, paint a certain picture. And most of the situations where people fall into big mistakes, and then they look back, they realize the extent to which they were deceived. Now, a psychologist can explain that to you. When you have a certain powerful feeling about something, so then your perception of the nature of that thing is distorted. So if you want to get to know the nature of a thing, you've got to study it very, very carefully. And that's why people are amazed when they're betrayed, for example, in love. They can't believe it. How could this person do this to me? Or in business, friendships, people are able to create impressions, to create images, and given the emotional state of the one that they're trying to affect, it's a very successful type of a technique. You feel very, very powerfully about something. You see things on TV. You see things in terms of advertising. The entire idolatry, for example. The entire world is emotionally attached to the most absurd ideas when it comes to religion. And there's virtually no limit to the absurdity of the idea. You see that in Christianity, you see that in Islam. Today you see that a person's emotions are so powerful that they can convince him that doing the most heinous deed will, that is to say, to become a suicide bomber, to destroy innocent people, will bring them the greatest possible glory. And the glory that they believe in is something which is absolutely absurd, that after death, they will find themselves in a new physical context, and they'll have all the same instincts and desires, and they'll be in a situation of endless physical pleasure. And there are millions and millions and billions of people that believe that. Much more people that believe that than the truths of the Torah, which are very unpopular. How is that possible? How is it possible that you will have millions of people believing in idolatry? That if they engage in the most absurd types of practices, which are directed at the most absurd types of forces that don't really exist, but they imagine, that they project onto reality, that these things are significant and will change their lives. How is it possible that nations like Nazi Germany, they'd be a perfect example of a movement, a very popular movement, that affected millions and millions of people and brought about probably, if not the greatest, catastrophe for the Jews, for the entire world. Millions and millions and millions, and all the destruction it was responsible for. It was a movement. It was very, very compelling. Take a look at the, not just the Germans, but all of Europe. The fascists were mesmerized by Hitler. I guess, according to this, there must be some truth in Nazism. There must be some truth in Christianity. There must be some truth in Islam. According to this, if you're going to follow the practical consequences, as we go around the world in this time and in any period of history, you'll see that the overwhelming majority of people were very, very firmly committed to attach the most significant beliefs in their lives were purely emotional, based upon emotions. Were not arrived at through any process of rational thought. And yet, using that approach, you see that it leads to the most absurd, that the strength of the conviction that the person has is in no way related to the veracity of the idea. To the contrary, it would seem to the opposite. The crazier the idea, the more it's attractive to human emotion. Contrarily, you see that all progress in the world, in history, has only been made to the extent that people are able to free their minds from the sway of emotion, even in science. The more people were under the sway of certain emotional beliefs which they couldn't free themselves from, the less they knew about the real world. The more they freed themselves and said, the only tool that we have which gives us access to the reality is the mind. And they began to apply to it the processes of reason and knowledge. To that extent, they began to learn how the world actually is. And that is the source of all progress. All progress in the world has to do with utilization of the mind. And the fact that I feel this way about something, no scientist, no doctor, any doctor that would say, I know all the data, but I feel that we should, that's a witch doctor. The witch doctor goes by absurd criteria. And there's very powerful emotions behind that. According to this, if you come upon a society that believes in voodoo, and there are societies like that, and they're suffering from a serious illness, a plague, and you have medicine, I guess you should say, well, there must be some truth in the voodoo since everybody believes in it. That's an absolute falsehood. The Torah itself does not maintain that that is the case. The Torah commands us to constantly oppose falsehood, idolatry. When it comes to our Molech, we don't say that there must be something good in our Molech. To the contrary, I'm not saying that that's what Shaul said. Shaul didn't spare the animals or a Gog because of this idea, because he believed there was something good. That was caving into a certain kind of pressure. So that was a sin. But the Torah demands that it be obliterated. Timcha Zecher Malach. It should be completely obliterated. And we don't say that there is certain good to it. So therefore, at first glance, on every level of human functioning, we see that the way the emotions work are that they deceive a person, that they distort the picture. A perfected individual, the more perfected you are, the more knowledge you have, so it does have an effect upon your emotions. That is to say that sometimes you have, the more you're familiar with an area, so you get a better sense. A good doctor can't always prove why he thinks this will work. But it's intuition. It's trained intuition. That's something else. That's part of the utilization of wisdom, of reason. There's different kinds of intuition. There's blind intuition, and nobody's going to go make a serious decision on the basis of blind intuition. But a person is a great investor, or a person is a great doctor, is very, very familiar with the ear. You'll always have certain things that you really can't say for sure. But you'll want to know, how do you feel about it? In that case, we're talking about a different how do you feel about it. It's an informed feeling. That is, a person can't say for sure, but my sense of things, because I'm so familiar with the phenomena, it seems to me. That's a different level. But there too, that person, if he could gain access to more information where he wouldn't have to rely on the feeling, and then he could utilize his mind, would of course want to do that. So it's no secret that we are subject to deception. The more we base ourselves on the feeling that is evoked within us, the less assurance we have that there's any kind of truth to it at all. And that's a foolish way to live. People that rush into relationships because they feel powerfully that this is the most wonderful person, without any basis for it, other than that they feel that way, are fools. They're living a life of foolishness. That's a life that would be condemned by the Torah, and these people will pay the consequences. Because there's no contradiction between a person being actually evil and that same person evoking within you the feeling that they're wonderful. That's the way things go in human relationships. However, I would like to know what was the basis for the other position. On what basis did any thinker come to the conclusion that every movement in history, most of these movements in history, by the way, the popular movements that we're talking about, were essentially destructive. Were negative, destructive, essentially based on falsehoods. Therefore, it's very hard to see how anybody could even come to such a conclusion. If you study history, you study these movements, you see how much harm they did, how they retarded the progress of the world. And if you know anything about human emotion, you know how subject to manipulation. That's politics. Even in a good country like the United States, it's time and time and time again. A politician comes to the fore, he has charisma, and people believe in him, and then the more you get to know him, the more it's a farce. The more they study the lives of people who are regarded as great men, the more they discover flaws and flaws and flaws, and it's contrary to the image that people had. Because a person has the ability to hide his flaws, a person has the ability to create an image, and there exists within people a very powerful desire to project what they would like to see onto someone else. When you project what you would like to see onto someone else, then you're not seeing reality, you're seeing something that you projected. But if you begin to treat it as reality, so that's absolutely, you're steeped in absolute falsehood. That's the whole basis of idolatry. That people don't search for the reality of the Creator. They have a certain image in their own mind, which is comforting to them, and they project it onto reality, and then they act as though it's real. Whereas it's completely false.